Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY2 resident. This is episode 130 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This will be series 10, and I'll be focusing on PEDS. So, and again, I'll try to knock this out fairly quickly because, again, I want to keep this short. So let's assume you get a question about, like a two-year-old kid, and this kid has had rhinorrhea for the last 2 days, and this kid, has like a mild fever. Let's say his temperature is like 100.9 or just like a 101, so like very low-grade fever. And then they tell you that this kid has been having like a barky cough. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're really thinking about croup, right? Remember croup? Remember, croup is caused by what bug? I hope you're telling me the parainfluenza virus, right? The parainfluenza virus. The parainfluenza virus causes croup, right? And the thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that croup is an upper airway problem. So in the MBME question, they're going to give you something along the lines of stridor, okay? They will give you more stridor, less wheezing on your exam. So I'll tell you this, on Pete's questions, you really want to pay attention to the wording. If you're seeing a lot of stridor, think about an upper airway problem like bacterial tracheitis, right? Or like croup, or like epiglottitis, right? But if you're telling you wheezing, you want to think about asthma, and you want to think about RSV pneumonia, okay? Although, right, if you see a kid in the first month of life that has pneumonia, you want to think more about group B strep. But most times on MBME exams, it's kids that are less than 2 years old that tend to get like RSV pneumonia. RSV is probably one of the most common causes of pneumonia in a kid that's less than a year old or thereabouts, but more than 20 days old. If you see within the first 20 days of life, you're thinking more about group B strep or strep agalactiae. So croup is caused by the parainfluenza virus. Again, remember, it's an upper airway problem, so you'll see stridor. Right, and those kids tend to have it's a subglottic problem. This is something your friends at the MBME can expect you to know, right? Because remember, right, epiglottitis is like above the glottis, right? But if you're seeing subglottic problems, you want to think more about croup, or you want to think more about bacterial tracheitis, right? And croup obviously will have that steeple sign that is classically found on radiography in patients that are affected with the disease. Right, and really, for the most part, croup, you just supportive care, the kid should be fine. But I said again, if you see like sudden onset, so notice for this croup question, I give you like this prodrome of like rhinorrhea and like sore throat and all that crap. But if you see a kid that like within a very short period of time, like over hours, they feel like crap, right? They just feel like super sick. They have very high fevers. Their temperature is like 103. They're having like grunting. They tell you that the kid is like tripoding, or like his mouth is like open and is like trying to catch air, right? If you see that, I really hope you're thinking about epiglottitis, right? Epiglottitis back in the day was caused a lot by H flu type B, but now we have like a conjugate vaccine against H flu type B, right? So we don't necessarily have many of those problems anymore, right? So strep pneumo can cause epiglottitis, staph aureus can cause epiglottitis. And the good thing is, I guess not necessarily a good thing, but a unique thing I want you to keep in mind is, don't just think of kids as the only ones that can get epiglottitis on an MBME, right? The thing is, your friends at the MBME have realized that, many people have seemed to memorize this association. If you see a kid, high fever, stridor, sudden onset, think about epiglottitis, right? So remember, people in their 20s can have epiglottitis. People in their 60s can have epiglottitis on MBME exams. So that's something you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind. And then one last thing I just want to say is, if they give you a question about a kid, right, that has like really bad bouts of cough, right? Like this kid like coughs a ton, right? And then they tell you that, after this kid coughs, this kid has like vomiting, or the kid like looks cyanotic, like becomes blue, or basically if they have like any change in the color of their skin with the cough because it's that severe, you should really be thinking about like pertussis, right? Like Bordetella pertussis. So what are the high yield things you want to keep in mind with Bordetella pertussis for your exam, right? You want to remember that, one, it's a bacterial infection. That's one. But because think about it. If a person has a bacterial infection, how does the immune system classically respond? Right? You have a leukocytosis, but what is the cell type that will be predominantly elevated in most bacterial infections? Well, I hope you're telling me it'll be neutrophils, right? But pertussis is kind of special in the sense that it causes, it's a bacterial infection, but the way your body actually responds to it is with lymphocytes. That's a high yield thing you want to keep in mind. And the thing is, pertussis is one of those rare things where it's an infection, but these people's white counts are like crazy high, like 70,000 sort of deal. So that's again some, that's like some high yield bit of trivia you want to keep in mind with pertussis, right? And again, obviously something that is a vaccine preventable, and if you want to treat it, right, you want to give the kid a macrolide like azithromycin or erythromycin or whatever, right? Although remember, erythromycin and your macrolides can prolong the QT interval, right? And if you're a close contact, right, this is actually very high yield to know, if you're a close contact of a person that has pertussis, right, you want to also go ahead and get a macrolide to cover yourself. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a newborn that has bilious vomiting? A newborn that has bilious vomiting. This is a way the MBME gets people all the time. So I'm going to spend like probably like 3-4 minutes on this. A newborn with bilious vomiting. What are the three things you should keep on your differential? You want to keep malrotation with volvulus as one thing on your differential. You want to keep duodenal atresia as another high yield thing on your differential. And then you want to keep jejunal atresia as a third thing on your differential, right? So malrotation with volvulus, duodenal atresia, jejunal atresia. Those are the three things you want to think about. So how do you get these things right on exams? Well, here's the algorithm you should basically follow. They try to, whenever your friends at the MBME write these bilious vomiting questions, they always write them to be like very nondescript so that it's hard for people to like get towards the answer. So here's the trick you should use. If you see bilious vomiting in a newborn, if they give you a picture on the exam, ask yourself these two questions. Do I see a double bubble? Or do I see a triple bubble? If you see a double bubble, obviously you should go ahead and pick duodenal atresia. If you see a triple bubble, you should obviously go ahead and pick jejunal atresia. If you don't see a double bubble or a triple bubble, then you should go ahead and pick malrotation with volvulus. Here's why. The thing is, your friends on the MBME, whenever they give malrotation, right, and they give a picture, they always pull that picture to mess with people's heads. The thing is, short of you being a radiologist, it's usually very hard to pick up what malrotation with volvulus looks like on an MBME exam. So just use almost like a picture process of elimination, and you will get these questions right a lot of the time, if not all the time, okay? If you don't see the fancy double bubble or the fancy triple bubble, you know it has to be malrotation, and you go with that answer, okay? Because again, I promise you, most times for most people, I'll say probably for like 90% of people taking the USMLEs, you will not be able to diagnose malrotation of volvulus just based on the picture. And it's usually like a crappy picture they will give you on the MBMEs. So what are the big things you want to keep in mind with these pathologies, right? Malrotation with volvulus, again, presents as bilious vomiting. It's a very non-specific presentation, but that's about as much as you can do on an MBME exam and still finagle your way to the answer, right? And you can do like an upper GI series to try to make the diagnosis, even if the upper GI series is not super, specific. But the thing is, it's one of those can't miss diagnoses because it can be rapidly fatal if it's not treated, right? That's one. Now, duodenal atresia, right? You already know this. It's classically found in kids with Downs, right? And remember that the buzzword pathophysiology you want to remember for your test is a failure of recanalization, right? Failure of recanalization. That's the buzz phrase of pathophys. And then for jejunal atresia, right? It's the one that's associated with a vascular problem, right? Your friends at the MBME will try to trick you by saying failure of recanalization. Failure of recanalization is not the pathophysiology behind jejunal atresia, Okay, and for duodenal atresia, you'll find your fancy double bubble, right? Because remember, right, you'll find your stomach bubble, and then you'll find the bubble distal to the pyloric sphincter. So that's your double bubble, right? So, but if you see a triple bubble, you know you're dealing more with a jejunal atresia. So that's how you always get those questions right on exams. Now, what if you get a question about a kid that, you know, has is like at the, I don't know, like 10th percentile for weight. This kid always has like foul-smelling stools, and this kid is having problems with like bone development, and their stools always like float. The kid is just tiny, doesn't seem to be developing, has failure to thrive. What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about celiac disease, right? I really hope you're thinking about celiac disease. Remember, celiac disease, right? It arises when you have like problems with like your microvilli, right? Like you have like immune mediated destruction of your microvilli, right? And obviously, if you want to go ahead and make that diagnosis, right, you want to check for antibodies against like tissue transglutaminase or anti-gliadin antibodies or like endomycial antibodies, right? And obviously, the way you treat is by withdrawing gluten from the diet, right? So those are some key things you want to keep with celiac disease. It's a thing that can cause a malabsorption. So why does this kid have these bone problems, right? Remember, if you have fat malabsorption, what are the vitamins you will not be able to reabsorb? Well, I hope you're telling me like vitamins A, D, E, and K, right? If you cannot reabsorb those vitamins, right? Like vitamin D, for example, you will have like you essentially have like rickets, right? The kid will have rickets. Or if you're dealing with an adult, you're thinking more about like osteomalacia, right? So under those circumstances, they will have like a secondary hyperparathyroidism where, because they're not reabsorbing vitamin D, right? They are not reabsorbing calcium and phosphate in their guts. So their calcium will be low, right? But because their calcium is low, their PTH will go up. If your PTH goes up, you'll trash your phosphate. So their phosphate will be low. Okay? So they can get a secondary hyperparathyroidism with that. With the vitamin K deficiency, they will have like recurring bleeds, right? Remember, vitamin K is kind of like an anticoagulant, if you may. Because it helps with the gamma carboxylation, right, of like factors 2, 7, 9, and 10 and our proteins are CNS, right? And then they can also have like acanthocytosis on a blood smear because they have that vitamin E deficiency. Remember, vitamin E is required for the maintenance of like appropriate membranes of stuff in your body, right? So if you're not maintaining your red blood cell membranes appropriately, you can have acanthocytes with that. Right. And then obviously, if the person has like the vitamin A deficiency, they can have like night blindness sort of deal. Right. So that's all I'm going to say about celiac disease. Well, actually, maybe not all of that. Right. But what's the dermatologic manifestation of celiac disease? I hope you're telling me about like some fancy rash on extensor surfaces. Right. So like you're classically described a dermatitis herpetiformis. Right. So that's one thing to know. Now, also remember, right, if they describe a person that has a history of like celiac and then they tell you that, oh, like over the past 3 months, they've lost a ton of weight, they have abdominal distension and all that crap, what are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like some kind of malignant degeneration, right? Remember that celiac can cause a kind of like a lymphoma. It's like they call it like an enteric associated lymphoma. I think it's like a T-cell lymphoma. So EATL, enteric associated T-cell lymphoma. That's one thing you want to keep in mind with a celiac disease. Now, what if they give you a question about a kid that has like intermittent? So this is the higher thing you want to remember. Not constant, intermittent abdominal pain. And then between episodes of that abdominal pain, they feel good. They feel okay. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about intussusception, right? Intussusception, again, remember, it arises when you have like telescoping of bowel. And the thing is, your friends at the MBME, right, they tend to give you certain clues that, oh, hey, you're dealing with intussusception, right? They'll give you clues like, I don't know, like recent upper respiratory infection or recent like GI infection, right? Those are things that can all predispose a person to having intussusception. Or alternatively, right, they can give you questions about like a person that has like a Meckel's diverticulum. Remember, Meckel's diverticulum can provide a lead point for intussusception, right? So if a person actually has a history of Meckel's diverticulum, you actually want to go ahead and avoid the rotavirus vaccine in those people because that can increase their risk of intussusception, right? Another one you may see on exams is if a person has a history of like IgA nephropathy, again, you also want to avoid the rotavirus vaccine in those people because, again, it can raise their risk of intussusception. And obviously for intussusception, right, your treatment is you want to do like an air or a contrast enema, right? That is both diagnostic and therapeutic, right? Now, what if you get a question about a kid that has they tell you that this kid has they tell you that this kid has like edema everywhere, and this kid had like an upper respiratory infection like a few days ago, and they tell you that this kid has 4+ proteinuria. What's your diagnosis? I really, really hope you're telling me minimal change disease. I know, that's why I kind of paused. I know many people like, that's essentially what I try to do. Try to trick you by saying, oh, upper respiratory infection. So I'm sure the thing that your mind went to first was either post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis or IgA nephropathy. Remember, post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis and IgA nephropathy are examples of nephritic syndromes, right? So those people will not have 4+ proteinuria, right? They will have like a non-nephrotic range proteinuria, so it'll be like 2+ or 3+ or whatever, and then they'll tell you that they have like red blood cell casts, right, or like dysmorphic erythrocytes in their urine. If you see that, you're like, oh, okay, this is a nephritic syndrome, so you want to think more about IgA nephropathy or post-streptococcal, or also called a post-infectious glomerulonephritis, right? So how do you differentiate between those two things? You differentiate between those two things by looking at when they had the upper respiratory infection, right? If they had it like 2 to 6 days ago, that's IgA nephropathy, right? If they had it like 2 to 6 weeks ago, you're thinking more about post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. Or if they tell you that this person had like a skin rash, right? Like that's typical of group A strep, right? And then they have like this hematuria. Again, you want to think about post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, right? And hopefully you remember for the PSGN, remember like the ASO titers, right? Or the anti-DNase B antibodies, especially when you have like a strep skin infection, right? So this kid that had upper respiratory infection has 4+ proteinuria. You're thinking about nephrotic syndrome, right? So remember, nephrotic syndrome, those people pee out more than like 3.5 grams of your protein in a 24-hour period. And minimal change disease is the most common cause. Very high yield to know that. It's the most common cause of nephrotic syndrome in kids. And it has a bunch of associations, right? So it has associations with like upper respiratory infections. It has associations with like liquid malignancies. So what do I mean by liquid malignancies? More like your hematologic malignancies, right? So like leukemia, lymphoma, and all that stuff. Those are all associated with minimal change disease, right? And remember, in nephrotic syndromes, right? Like minimal change disease, for example, by peeing out all that protein in your urine, what's happening to your oncotic pressure? Well, with that oncotic pressure, right, that low oncotic pressure, you're getting like edema everywhere, right? So they can get like facial edema, they can get arm edema, they can get leg edema, like peripheral edema, they can even get ascites, right? That ascites can become infected. They can get many problems with that. They can get like SBP, where you have to do like a paracentesis to find the more than 250 neutrophils and treat with like a third-gen cephalosporin, like cefotaxime, for example, right? They can have DVTs from the nephrotic syndrome, right? Because as they pee out that antithrombin 3 in their urine, right? Remember, antithrombin 3 is an inhibitor of factors 10 and 2. So if you waste that antithrombin 3 in the urine, you no longer inhibit factors 10 and 2, you become hypercoagulable, right? Or those kids, right, they can have like a Budd-Chiari syndrome where they can get like a thrombosis of the hepatic vein, right? Or they can get like a thrombosis of the renal vein, right? Or they can get like a splenic vein thrombosis. Although remember, usually when you see Budd-Chiari syndrome, they usually ask that in the setting of like polycythemia vera. Whenever you see a splenic vein thrombosis, they usually ask that in the setting of pancreatitis on MBME exams, right? But if you see renal vein thrombosis, you really, really want to think about some kind of nephrotic syndrome. It can arise in any kind of nephrotic syndrome, but classically on MBMEs, they go after membranous nephropathy as the inciting agent with a renal vein thrombosis. And then, just, I guess, sort of like a quick association review here. What if they give you a question about a kid that's getting like recurrent like staph abscesses, or they're getting like recurrent like candidal infections or aspergillus infections? What are you thinking about there? Well, I hope you're thinking about CGD, right? Chronic granulomatous disease, where they have like an NADPH oxidase deficiency, right? So the oxidative burst mechanism that operates in neutrophils is all screwed up. Okay, now what if you get a question about a kid that has like an anaphylactic reaction with like blood transfusions, or they tell you that this kid keeps getting like recurrent like giardial diarrhea or like recurrent upper respiratory infections? What are you thinking about there? I really hope you're thinking about IgA deficiency with that, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a kid that's having recurrent upper respiratory infections, recurrent giardial infections, and it's a boy. So how you to know this? It's a boy. And all these things seem to have started after 6 months of age. What are you thinking about there? I hope you're thinking about Bruton's A-gamma globulinemia, right? Remember, it's like a problem with like B-cell maturation. So those kids will tend to get recurring bacterial infections. And if they give you a GI infection, it's almost always Giardia on an MDME exam, right? And obviously for those people, you give them monthly IVIG as treatment. And again, they will have mostly bacterial infections, not viral, not fungal, okay? Mostly bacterial infections. Now, what if they give you a question about a kid that's born? This kid has seizures and they tell you that, oh, on an EKG, you see like a prolonged QT interval and the kid is getting like recurrent infections with like pneumocystis jervetzi. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're really, really telling me about, the George syndrome, right? Remember, that's where your third and fourth pouches don't form, right? So your thymus doesn't form, so your T cells are gone, right? So you have like recurring viral and fungal infections. And then because your parathyroids are gone, right? You get hypocalcemia. Hypocalcemia can cause seizures, right? Or it can also present as a prolonged QT on an EKG. Remember that infants of diabetic moms can also get hypocalcemia, right? So if you see like seizures in an infant of a diabetic mother, right? You want to think about like hypoglycemic seizures or hypocalcemic seizures. So I think I'm going to maybe go ahead and, let me talk about these two other immunodeficiencies. So what if you get a question about a kid that has, recurrent like infections and they tell you that they give you like a CBC and you find that his platelet count is like 40,000 and they tell you that this kid has like pigmented lesions on his skin. What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, right? Remember, though the association with like thrombocytopenia, right? So like low platelets and eczema, right? And again, it's going to be in a boy on an MBME. Basically, the boy immunodeficiency syndromes on your MBME are things like Wiskott-Aldrich, CGD, and Bruton's A-gamma globulinemia. Those disorders should not show up in girls. They are all inherited in an X-linked recessive fashion on MBME. So again, very high yield to know those things. And I guess I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I really want to keep this short. I want to kind of make up for the very long podcast I made yesterday that is very high yield. And then as I say at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for a ton of exams, right? So like step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three, the preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, like the in-training exams, the ABIM board exams, I do offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're a college student and you need tutoring for like Gen Chem, O-Chem, physics, biochem, physiology, histology, offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're a med student applying to a residency, right, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to a med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer like advising and consulting for those on a one-on-one basis, right? So things like personal statements, mock interviews, preparing your actual application, letters of recommendation, I assist with all those things. So just reach out to me through the website, or you can send out an email, Divine Intervention Podcasts, with an S at the end, at gmail.com. I'd be happy to point you in the right direction. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I will see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.